Well, Bethany, I wondered if you could start by helping us think about the relationship that China has with Russia and really take us back in time before this invasion, maybe back before even Russia started its activity in Crimea. How were those two countries viewing one another and how has that evolved?
I can take you back even further.
This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
And this is Beth Silvers.
Thank you for joining us for Pantsuit Politics.
Hello, and thank you so much for joining us here at Pantsuit Politics, where we try to take a different approach to the news. Today, we're going to talk about the historic confirmation hearings underway for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Biden's nominee to replace Justice Stephen Breyer on the Supreme Court. Then we're going to turn our focus back to Ukraine, but a little different angle. We're going to share a conversation with Bethany Allen Abrahamian from Axios about China and how the Chinese Communist Party fits into our understanding of the war in Ukraine. Finally, with the Oscars coming, Sarah, one of your favorite times of year.
It's my favorite time of year. It's not March Madness.
And at listener Lizzie's request, we're going to talk about Best Picture nominee Don't Look Up and its messaging. But first, we're really excited about our book. Sarah, you want to tell them where we are?
Yes. Now What is launching in less than 6 weeks. These last few weeks before launch are so important to the success of our book, and we need your help. First, if you haven't pre-ordered the book yet, it would mean so much to us if you would do that through your favorite book retailer. You can find a link to do that in our show notes. And second, once you pre-order the book, we would love for you to join our launch team. This is an exclusive group. We'll be popping in from time to time over there, doing some Facebook Lives with this group. You get to read the book early. You help us spread the word about the book. You help us successfully launch the book, hence why it's called a launch team. There is also a link to sign up for the launch team in our show notes. So any help you can give, greatly appreciated.
My friend Jen is so good at saying that she's going to be my hype person, and I feel like the launch team is like our hype people.
That's right.
Many of you have asked what you can do to help, so here it is. Thank you so much.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
Before we talk about a historic nominee to the Supreme Court, we need to commemorate the life of another woman who made history. On Wednesday, Madeleine Albright died at the age of 84. She was the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. She was nominated by President Clinton, first to serve as representative to the UN and then to lead the State Department. And that made her, at the time, the highest ranking woman in the history of American government. And her personal backstory is so touching, Sarah. I wondered what all stood out to you about her career and her life story.
Yeah, her history is amazing. Her parents were Czech refugees. They fled the Nazis. They raised her as a Roman Catholic during World War II to protect all of them. So her early childhood, and just my favorite anecdote about Madeleine Albright, is the way she would use her pens to communicate, like, her mood or strategy. Apparently it all started when Saddam Hussein called her a serpent, and so she started wearing a serpent pen. And then she was like, well, this is fun. Maybe I could do this for lots of things. Like, I just think it's such a, like, clever but also fun way to, I guess, like, flip on its head the idea that everybody's probably watching what the first secretary, female Secretary of State, is wearing anyway. And so why not use it to your advantage? Why not make it fun for you as well? I just think it's, and it's reflective, it seems like, you know, because sometimes it was communicating, like, do not mess with me today, which she had a real vibe like that, which I also appreciated. You know, she was just brilliant and such a history maker. And incredible, incredible diplomat and thinker on the world stage. And she will be missed for sure.
I keep her book, Fascism, a Warning, on the shelf behind me where I work every day. And I wanted to share this paragraph from the preface, which I think she wrote in 2018, because I felt like, one, it was highly relevant to everything we're talking about today. And two, because it feels representative to me of how incisive and direct and thoughtful she was. According to an old Czech saying, it's no trick to make soup from a fish, but making a fish out of soup is a challenge. In the chapters to come, I argue that ambitious, often arrogant leaders are intentionally undermining the institutions and democratic principles that have held the world together through much of my life. Without offering anything real or better, they ask us to abandon the ideals of international cooperation, political pluralism, civil discourse, critical thinking, and truth. The longer these false prophets have their way, the more damage they will wreak, and the more difficult it will be to heal the wounds they are opening. The trend is worldwide, and among those most directly affected are Americans.
It's mighty prescient.
Madeleine Albright will be missed. But from one historic commemoration to another, President Biden has nominated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer as an associate justice on the Supreme Court. And it seemed like a good time to talk more about her. We've only briefly touched on this nomination, but there's a lot to say because she has a resume really similar to what we're used to in Supreme Court justices, but also brings a variety of new and fresh perspectives, many of which have been kind of spelled out for us in really beautiful ways during her testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, she's only 51 years old, another young justice joining the court. Her parents were public school administrators, so she's one of the few justices that went to public school. The rest went to Catholic school. She also, fun trivia fact, went to the same high school as Jeff Bezos, which I thought was fascinating. She has a very elite resume as far as her college and law school education. She went to Harvard for undergrad, Harvard for law school. She was the editor of the Harvard Law Review. She's worked in private practice as well as clerking for federal judges, including Justice Breyer. So she has a very elite resume.
She does. And in addition to that, her life story is compelling. You know, she talked about her dad going to law school and him having a stack of law books on the table next to her stack of coloring books. She has an uncle who served as Miami's police chief. She has another uncle who was sentenced to life in prison in Florida for a nonviolent drug offense. That sentence was commuted by President Obama. So just lots of life experience. And some of that is coming up in these hearings in terms of her time as a public defender, in terms of her experience on the bench and how she sentenced criminal defendants. I think the salient thing to note about particularly the Republican questioning of her in these hearings is that biography is not the issue. Everyone understands that she is qualified to serve on the court, well qualified. In fact, I think as we're recording, there are experts from the American Bar Association and otherwise testifying about how well qualified she is to serve on the court. And so having nothing biographical to go after, having nothing in her qualifications to go after, there is a real attempt to narrow in on specific moments in her career to make policy points, to score political points. But as citizens, I think we should feel comforted that this isn't like a food fight over her personal integrity or her academic pedigree. Instead, it is just a food fight because we have decided that's what we do in committee hearings.
Yeah, it's not an accident, though, that she can't forcefully and aggressively defend herself against these very spurious, like, teeny tiny piecemeal. Well, let me pull out this one thing from several years ago, or this one thing, or this one piece of this decision, or this sentence. You said this at this sentencing hearing. Like, she just sits there calmly, taking, you know, deep measured breaths and responding very, very carefully, often quoting Justice Amy Coney Barrett or Justice Kavanaugh and their answers at their confirmation hearings. I thought that was a very interesting approach that she's taken and very smart approach. I did want to ask you, Beth, I think the one thing she said that sort of got my attention was when asked about sort of her guidelines around interpreting constitutional law, she said, well, this court has made clear that we interpret the Constitution basically in an originalist way. We look at what the people who wrote it meant and what the limitations of that time period. I don't think many people, I certainly didn't expect her to say that. And I couldn't tell if she was just saying, like, that's what they do. That's what this court has decided is the approach. Or if she was just, like, describing it or saying, like, well, because that's the way they do it, that's why we will all do it.
I think it was Senator Sasse who asked her what Supreme Court justice she models herself after, and she declined to answer that and said that she follows her own compass. So I hate to do to her what she declined to do herself, but I'm going to do that for a second and say that that answer and many of her answers reminded me of Justice Kagan, where you have this kind of long-term strategy in mind about protecting the institution, about making sure that you are absolutely consistent in the way that you approach answering questions like this and then approach taking cases on. Because Justice Kagan, you can see, is in for fierce protection of precedent. Mm-hmm. And she's like in for a penny and a pound, as my grandmother would have said. And I think that we got some indication that a Justice Jackson might follow that path. I think her temperament in these hearings also feels very Kagan-esque to me, that she is doing her best to show a real respect for everyone in the process, a real understanding that she would be a Supreme Court justice, not just for sort of the progressive left, but for everyone. Which, if you read Justice Kagan's opinions, I think that that's really the approach she tries to take too. She really holds her cards close. Her legal analysis is very sharp. What I have read of Judge Jackson's opinions as a circuit and district judge indicate that to me as well. So I find that encouraging.
And, you know, as much as we've spent on the ways in which she is similar to the current Supreme Court justices and pedigree, it is important to point that there are ways that she is very dissimilar. Obviously, she is a historic nominee because she would be the first Black woman to serve on the Supreme Court. And very importantly, the first public defender. And that's why this was an easy opening to talk about criminal defense, Democrats being soft on crime. But, you know, it is sort of equally depressing to me that she is the first Black woman and the first public defender, because those are just massive, important perspectives to American life that have been missing from the court until this moment. The fact that we would have a Supreme Court for hundreds of years that wouldn't have the perspective of defendants, people who are, you know, tasked with defending those at the mercy of our criminal justice system, is just incredible. And in the same way, you know, the fact that we've never had a Black woman on the Supreme Court to bring that incredibly important perspective, it's not an accident to me that we're having so many conversations about the future of the court, the integrity of the court. And we're just now, you know, basically just beginning to plug these massive holes in the ship, right? No wonder the ship is sinking, because it's been missing these very important perspectives.
I was talking to my 11-year-old daughter about this, and I asked her if she knew what a public defender was. She did not. So we talked about the Miranda warning that she has seen in movie after movie. And here's what that part where you have a right to an attorney and one will be provided if you can't afford it means. And I said, what you should know as somebody trying to figure out would she be a good Supreme Court justice or not is that public defenders take so many cases. They go to court more than almost anybody. They try so many cases. They actually get experience that if you work at a big law firm, you only dream of, you know, because those cases settle. They get tied up in discovery forever. Public defense is where the action happens. And it's a huge variety of cases and a huge swath of the public that you interact with. And what I think is really encouraging and hopeful about her as a Supreme Court justice, about anyone with this experience as a Supreme Court justice, but especially her, is that we want people to sit on the court who would represent a detainee at Guantanamo Bay because they are so committed to the rights enumerated in the Constitution. They are so committed to the idea that everyone coming up against the government deserves to be treated by the government in a way that honors those rights. I talked about a Supreme Court case, a recent decision on More to Say this week that involved a Guantanamo Bay detainee. And it just became so clear to me thinking about him. Here is a person who has done terrible things. And it's awful when you have a person who's done terrible things. But when you have a government that does terrible things, that is more significant socially. And so to have somebody sit on the court who has said, I will stand up against the government doing terrible things, even to a terrible person, I really appreciate that. So we hope that Judge Jackson will be confirmed quickly and that we can all celebrate that new level of representation on the Supreme Court. We're going to turn our attention now to Ukraine. There was a piece from David French this week. I feel like we have mentionitis about David French. He just keeps coming up in our conversations. But he's really written some excellent pieces lately. And he talked about how American attention on Ukraine is waning and what a danger that is for the Ukrainian people. So we don't want to contribute to that problem. We want to sustain our focus, even though it is difficult. And we want to try to understand different angles. So today you're going to hear a conversation with Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, the China reporter at Axios. Bethany writes high impact investigations, exclusives, and analysis about China with a focus on how China projects power and influence beyond its own borders. And we really appreciated her insights. Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, I cannot believe how young you look. And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
You know how you learn to really appreciate how good your products are? Leave town and get stuck with whatever shampoo is in the hotel. I take Pros and their custom hair products for granted, y'all. Pros is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. From millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely yours or mine. I never found beauty products that really understood my needs. But ever since I switched to custom hair and skin routine with Pros, I've noticed so many benefits. My thin hair is moisturized but not weighed down, and my waves have never looked better. And Pros isn't just better for you, it's better for the planet. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit.
In previous episodes, I have outed myself as a bed-making fanatic. I am very serious about my bed being an oasis, a gift to Chad and me as we crawl into it at the end of a long day. So I want to return to how much I love my Boll & Branch sheets. With Boll & Branch sheets, you can discover a new level of softness. The sheets are made from 100% organic cotton in a buttery, breathable weave that truly gets softer every time you wash them. And you know that I like to do that once a week, so my Boll & Branch are rapidly aging like a fine wine. The sheets look great. I have them in a beautiful slate color. They stay put, so making my bed is quick and easy. They are a bestseller for a reason. The signature sheets feel incredible on night one. They are loved by millions of sleepers, and they come with a 30-night worry-free guarantee. Sleep better at night with the softest sheets from Boll & Branch. Get 15% off your first order when you use promo code PANTSUIT at bollandbranch.com. That's Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com, promo code PANTSUIT. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Well, Bethany, I wondered if you could start by helping us think about the relationship that China has with Russia and really take us back in time before this invasion, maybe back before even Russia started its activity in Crimea. How were those two countries viewing one another and how has that evolved?
I can take you back even further. I can take you back to the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. So for the first, 15, 20 years, after the founding of the People's Republic, meaning after the Chinese Communist Party took over, China had a very, very close relationship with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union sent scientists, sent assistants, was really China's big brother. Very, very close relationship there. And China was very reliant on the Soviet Union, especially in the early years before China had diplomatic recognition from a lot of other countries. But then I believe it was in the late 60s, around there, there was something called the Sino-Soviet split. And I won't really get into the reasons for that. It was somewhat ideological and other stuff. But basically, it is what it sounds like. China and Russia had a big diplomatic split. And so for a couple decades, relations between them were not close. And that's actually one of the things that played into the U.S. eventually recognizing China, because they saw this as a strategic opening to kind of, pull apart the communist bloc a little bit.
And we get Nixon's visit to China, and that was sort of the strategy there.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and another complicating factor in their relationship that lasted well beyond the fall of the Soviet Union was some territorial disputes. China and Russia share a very, very long border and have numerous small territorial disputes that caused some minor skirmishes over the years, I think even into the 90s. But by the 2000s, China and Russia had finally resolved those. Territorial disputes between two countries serve as a real irritant in relations, and it's often hard for two countries to build a really strong relationship and build really strong trust when they have that kind of ongoing friction on their border. So by clearing up those territorial disputes and resolving them, that set the stage for Moscow and Beijing to start building, to start really going somewhere with their relationship. And that also approximately coincided with China's gradual turn towards a more hardline authoritarianism. We can trace that to around 2008, but really in 2012, when Xi Jinping became General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. And 2012, important year for that. 2014, with Russia's annexation of Crimea, that was a very important event in the Russia-China relationship, because Putin relied on China at that time because there were some initial Western sanctions on Russia. And that was when the mood, the perspective on Russia in the West really started to change. It was a pretty shocking event. I remember in 2014 seeing the word annex, you know, annexation appearing in headlines. And I was like, I haven't seen that. Like, this feels like World War II to me, yeah. You know, when did things in Europe get annexed? And so that pushed Russia closer to China. And that sort of closer relationship is something that Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin have really worked towards and built in the past 8 years. Their personal relationship is very strong and very close. I can't remember the exact number of bilateral visits they've had with each other in recent years. It's like, you know, up in the double digits, 14 or something like that. It's not for show. They really get each other. There's a certain authoritarian learning curve that they share where they're learning from each other. Russia is learning from China's crackdown on the internet. China is learning from Russia's use of online disinformation operations. They're both, and the thing that really ties them, rather than actual shared values, for example, or specific shared strategic interests, is that they're both opposed to the US-led liberal world order to the extent that it exists, or, you know, even though it's not perfect, but that exists. And they don't want it to, or they want it to be greatly weakened. They both share that goal, and they both are very useful to each other in providing, posing parallel challenges to Europe and to the West.
So that brings us through this warming, right? And we come to the opening of the Olympics, and we have the No Limits Partnership. And, you know, in the context of that close relationship, I also have to believe that China probably felt like the rest of the world, like this was going to go a lot more like Crimea and less like a full scale invasion that led to this alliance of the West. And so I wonder now how Xi Jinping feels about that relationship. I wonder if, you know, there's so much analysis that talks about how China values stability, but Russia doesn't. If he's seen the sort of inherent weaknesses in this relationship.
I mean, I think you're exactly right that China's top leadership and frankly, Russia's top leadership probably did not anticipate how fierce the pushback in Ukraine would be, how fierce the resistance would be, and how strong and unified the response of the West would be. My guess is that, you know, China's top leadership thought that this would be more like, you know, the annexation of Crimea, that we would see a similar pattern, a little bit of fighting, kind of a little bit of ongoing low-level unrest resulting from that, you know, the U.S. and Europe being kind of displeased and slapping a few symbolic sanctions, yep. But not doing much more. But this was just such a fundamentally different reaction. So I think that, you know, I don't really love it when I hear people say China's in a tough position, because no, they could just not support a dictator. You know, they're putting themselves in that position. You know, but I think they definitely want to have their cake and eat it too. And that is a very, you know, fine needle that they're having to thread by doing that. They do not want Russia to collapse. They don't want Putin to, you know, be pushed out of the leadership, because that would leave China as the sole, you know, major national security threat and strategic threat to the US and Europe, which would, you know, unify the West's ability to push back against China. China finds the, you know, Putin very useful. But they also, you know, realize that they don't want to alienate Europe. Up until the past couple of years, China has managed to keep Europe, to convince them that all China wants is a nice trade relationship, that they're not a threat, that they don't need to be pushed back against. And Europe in the past couple of years has started to kind of wake up to the kind of major challenge that China does actually pose to values and to the liberal order. But they're certainly far behind the US in that realization. And China would like to keep them that way. China has publicly encouraged Europe to pursue strategic autonomy, which is the idea that Europe should pursue a foreign policy that's separate from the US. So Xi Jinping wants both of those things. You know, he wants to have a good relationship with Europe and he wants Russia to continue to be strong. That is what he cares about. He does not care about Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chinese Communist Party doesn't actually really care about what happens to Ukraine. It doesn't really care about the suffering of the Ukrainian people or about the loss of, you know, chunks of Ukraine, the loss of their sovereign territory. And in fact, there have been a number of, you know, people speculating about how much China is learning about this, you know, vis-a-vis Taiwan. I wouldn't overdo that comparison, but I certainly don't think it's bad for China, for how it views its future, for there to be a precedent of, you know, a revanchist, revisionist authoritarian power taking a chunk of territory that it views as rightfully its own. That would not be harmful to China's, you know, goals for itself. That's the reason for, you know, what appears to be a kind of waffling on China's part or a kind of strategic ambiguity.
That's interesting.
You anticipated my question because I'm going to think about the phrase authoritarian learning curve for a while. And we keep hearing, you know, China is watching as it relates to Taiwan. We don't really hear a lot of like the people of Taiwan are watching. Do you think there is a learning on that side of the equation vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. I'm in close touch with quite a number of people in Taiwan who are very concerned about that, you know, Taiwan's future. And they are most definitely watching the world's response to Ukraine. They're watching Beijing's response to Ukraine, and they're watching the Ukrainian response to Ukraine. How are Ukrainian people pleading their case on the global stage? Mm-hmm. How is the Ukrainian government fighting Russian disinformation? To what extent has the West stood up for Ukraine, and where have they not? And, you know, one place where they haven't is, for example, in creating a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which is what Ukrainians really want. So that's, you know, one thing the West hasn't done, but there has been a very strong unified economic response. You know, some of this is, as I said, the comparison is a bit limited because China's economy is 10 times the size of Russia's. And Russia is already the largest economy, you know, to ever be shut out of the global economy in this way through these kinds of sanctions. It's not possible to do that to China. It's just not possible. And it's just as it's not possible to do it to the U.S. You know, we invaded Iraq and nobody wanted us to do that. And we did not suffer crushing sanctions because right. It's not possible. So, you know, in Taiwan's case, there will not be, it's extremely unlikely there would be such a strong and unified economic response. And Taiwanese, you know, people know that.
I'm struck by when you say, you know, we talk about this and you say they, the Chinese Communist Party. We don't use they a lot when we talk about Russia because Vladimir Putin is so, so isolated. And they, you know, the reporting is that it's gotten worse through COVID. You know, I was struck. I was listening to an expert and they said, like, we know what happens if Xi Jinping passes away. Like, we understand the process and how the replacement will come about. We don't have that in Russia. We don't know what happens if something happens to Vladimir Putin. And so that tells me, like, there's influence, there's elites, there's a wider sort of conversation surrounding him than there is Vladimir Putin. And I'm wondering what they're taking in, what the conversation is there. I read some reporting that there's been a lot of attention, particularly in the lead up to the invasion when there was so much public disclosure of intelligence and intelligence penetration inside Russian circles. I'm sure the Chinese were watching that, wondering how deep does that go inside our circles? I agree with you that that's not possible in China, but I do think under a certain global pressure, you could see private corporations leaving China. I wonder if they're watching that. Do you have a sense of how sort of the elites inside the Chinese Communist Party and inside the Chinese economy are thinking or influencing Xi Jinping, especially as he heads into a pretty unprecedented third term?
That's a great question. And, you know, now we're getting into the territory of like Beijing palace intrigue, you know, elite power politics in China, which is a very fascinating topic, totally different from Western power politics, to be sure. You know, the thing to understand about China is that it's a Leninist system, which means that it's, you know, a top-down, very heavily bureaucratic party control with very strong inter-party discipline. And the system that emerged after the Cultural Revolution when Mao Zedong was in power, which was an extreme cult of the personality where one man had an enormous amount of power and wreaked havoc because of that, because there was no one powerful enough to check him. The system that emerged after that was something called, I guess, a rule by consensus, or, you know, kind of a consensus-based leadership, where there was a strong discouragement for there to be a single, you know, to have cult of the personality again. And there was, so the Politburo Standing Committee, which is, I think, 9 people, a small number of people, that's, you know, that is the real power base. And while there's a general secretary, you know, it was a kind of a rule by consensus of those top leaders, without a lot of visibility into the debates and the arguments that they're having. What has happened under Xi Jinping is that he has kind of shredded that. Mm. So there is a real cult of the personality now in China, very much centered around Xi Jinping. And he has, you know, his power consolidation means that he really is calling the shots. He has marginalized and felled, you know, any sense of opposition within the party to his power. In terms of elites, you know, are there people, are there groups in China, you know, powerful elites who inform what he does? That's probably, I mean, he has advisors, but he has been, you know, very intent on making sure that no one can force him to do something that he doesn't want to do. Mm. And this is, there's a real risk here. He's gone so far with it. And this is, you know, this is why things happened so badly under Chairman Mao in the 1960s and 70s, is that people can't give him better advice. Right. They can't really push back against him. And there's a really good example of this that kind of emerged actually over the weekend. We hear very little now about inner party debates on these major issues. However, there was an article that was published in Chinese with an English translation on a US-based website, small, you know, US-based website over the weekend by someone named Hu Wei, who is a top research advisor to China's state council, which is the highest government governing body, not the party governing body. And he made a very, very strong, I mean, really striking criticism of China's policy regarding Ukraine. Now, he didn't use the name Xi Jinping, but China's policy regarding Ukraine is Xi Jinping's policy regarding Ukraine. And he said, here's what's going to happen. If we do not join with the West in their opposition to Russia, you know, we are going to be isolated. We're going to anger everyone, and there's going to be a united bloc against us. We cannot do this. Also, Russia's losing. There's no way for them to win. We don't want to be on the losing side here. That's really unusual. It is really, really rare to hear that kind of criticism. This is speculation, but my guess is that he took this risk publishing this because he feels so desperate mm-hmm. about it, because he wants it to get some attention, because no one is listening to him. And I don't know what's going to happen to him, but you can get a sense there of that sort of inner party silence, really.
Wow. I was struck reading about that article in your newsletter this morning, Bethany, and how you said, here's what to watch for. What happens to this person? And that leads me to ask you about the way that China uses information. I feel, as an American, especially in the midst of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, like an unwilling student in a long seminar about what disinformation really looks like. And I think we're getting a better sense here in the United States of what it looks like for a government to put propaganda out into the stream in well-disguised ways. I still don't think we have any sense of what the censorship side of this, what China does really well, looks like and what it means. Can you put that in some context for us? And maybe if you're willing, even share, I think you've had some personal experience with this as well. I would love to hear about that.
So China's done, you know, the thing that people thought was impossible, that President Clinton said would be like nailing Jell-O to the wall, which is censoring the internet, truly, truly blocking out, stamping out opinions that a government doesn't like. And China has become extremely good at that, extremely successful at that. And they've institutionalized that throughout their, not just their law, but also inside of private corporations. And as a result of that, you know, propaganda and censorship are kind of a 1-2 punch for controlling public opinion. And I always try to tell people that the reason governments like China pour literally billions and billions of dollars this is because it works. It works. And in China, around the Ukraine issue, for example, what we've seen is very intense censorship of pro-Ukraine opinions, even facts, like just basic facts that cast the Russian invading army in a negative light. So, you know, lots of censorship of, you know, information about maternity hospitals being bombed, you know, or children's hospitals being bombed, this kind of thing. And on top of that, an enormous wave of pro-Russia information being amplified by Chinese state media and, you know, online influencers and Chinese government officials. So the Chinese internet and the entire Chinese information ecosystem, if you were just awash in it and not really trying to figure out what's really going on, it will appear to you as though the US and NATO have been provocateurs, the Russian army is trying to free Ukraine from Nazis, and is exhibiting remarkable restraint, is trying to help Ukrainians, et cetera. And that's what you will really believe. Why are they doing that? Why are they doing that on this particular case? And there's a really important concept here to understand, which is that the Chinese government does not want to face domestic pressure, change their policy. So if Chinese people were to realize or to understand the enormous civilian cost to just normal people, normal families in Ukraine, and to understand that this was truly an actual invasion, that it's a war, and that it was unprovoked. Chinese people are human beings just like the rest of us. They would get extremely upset, and that would put pressure on Xi Jinping to change his policy, which would restrain his ability to make choices on the international stage, and he doesn't want that. Mm. So that's the point in this case of that kind of pressure. Now, the question for information, the Chinese government does use disinformation domestically, although we've tended to call that more like propaganda. So like, you know, TV airings of forced confessions, for example. Mm. Disinformation is something that the Russian government has really perfected. And I think, you know, some analysis of that would be because it's more useful in an environment where you have fewer controls. So if you're trying to project your beliefs or what you want people to believe beyond your borders, you can't really do so as well. But disinformation is transnational. And in Russia's case, now in the past 2 weeks, they have really shut down their online space and censored a lot of things. But before that, it wasn't a free environment, but people could get information pretty freely if they wanted to. And so disinformation was more useful to Russia, you know, even domestically, because they didn't have that kind of control. I don't know if that answers your question that I wanted about disinformation, how it works.
No, I think that's really helpful. I was struck with an interview with Stephen Kotkin in The New Yorker about how he was talking about authoritarian governments. And he said that they're all powerful but brittle at the same time. The information gets worse, the sycophants get greater, and they can't correct in the same way that we can. And I wonder, as you look at the Chinese Communist Party, where do you see that brittleness? Where do you see that weakness in the structure?
I have heard that argument many times.
Or I guess I should only say, do you agree with it?
I only think it's true sometimes. Mm. And I think there's a big risk to applying it to all autocratic regimes. And that risk is, it presumes that at some point in time soon, that government will collapse.
Right.
And you don't even need to do anything. It'll just collapse in on itself. And, you know, that was one of the West's biggest strategic mistakes when it came to China, mm-hmm. was expecting that democracy would inherently win out and that authoritarianism would inherently fall.
Right.
And I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's true. And I think it's important to presume that it's not true. On the question of brittleness, I do think that there comes a point where, you know, as in China during the Cultural Revolution, dissent, even loyal dissent, was so marginalized that, you know, basic governing decisions were being made very poorly, you know, about the starvation happening in the provinces that they governed, you know, so there was just a lack of knowledge. That kind of thing is brittleness, absolutely. But, you know, before that point, I'm not sure. And I think it's possible for there to be an overlay of brittleness and an overlay of resiliency. And I would say that's much more closer to what we're seeing in China. And I'll give some examples of that. Here's a actually very, very specific example of what I would call a type of brittleness. So recently, or last year, I think, the Chinese government issued an interesting guideline prohibiting hackers, white hat hackers, from selling vulnerabilities online, but rather they're required to hand them over to the government so the government can use them for strategic purposes.
Wow.
Okay. Well, that's great from the government's perspective. They can, you know, now they can hack into more people. However, what's the problem? Well, this is actually a problem of capitalism and free markets. So white hat hackers are in part motivated to find vulnerabilities because they can get a lot of money for them by selling them. You know, selling a zero-day vulnerability can get you a lot. A reward. It gets you a reward from that company, right? You report it to them and they reward you for it, to be clear. And the Chinese government is not doing that. So it has removed a market incentive. And as a result of that, one can very reasonably presume, you know, with as an informed presumption, that now fewer vulnerabilities are being found because hackers are not incentivized to find them as much. And that makes everyone, all the companies in China, less secure. Now that's a tiny, tiny little, you know, pinpoint in a much larger landscape of how some processes are weakened or stop functioning in a society where there's too much top-down control and too much repression. That's certainly the case in China. However, if you can have an effective bureaucracy, you know, authoritarianism can respond very quickly to crises and can cut through some of the slower processes that can bog down democracies. And if anything, in the past 10 years, the Chinese Communist Party has become a much more efficient governing bureaucracy. I do not see that brittleness.
Thinking about authoritarianism in the details is a helpful framework. And I think that your newsletter is such a helpful way for us to all continue to do that. Those of us who don't have the kind of history and context that you provide about China, being able to check in regularly with those detailed examples has aided me tremendously in just trying to understand what's going on in the world. So thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today and always through your newsletter at Axios.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups, no more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. You guys, I love my Aura frames. I have one in my office. I have one in my kitchen. I have given one as a housewarming gift. I have given one as Mother's Day, Father's Day. They are the most amazing gifts because this app is a game changer, in my personal opinion, in digital frames. It makes it so, so easy to get the pictures on there and even videos. It plays like you're in Harry Potter, you guys. It is the best. I love mine so much. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you so much to Bethany for joining us. Sarah, we're going to turn to, as you said, your March Madness, the Oscars, and particularly talk about Don't Look Up.
Yes, lots of people emailed us and said, what do you think about Don't Look Up? I don't think it's going to win Best Picture, so let's just go ahead and clear that right away. It is nominated, and it's very reflective of writing and directing of Adam McKay. I think he's the writer and the director, who did Vice and The Big Short. He's the production behind Succession. And if you haven't seen it, if you haven't seen Don't Look Up, everybody's in it, all the stars. Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, Leonardo DiCaprio, Timothée, I love him. I love him so much. Cate Blanchett, Ariana Grande, Jonah Hill. And it's about scientists discovering that there's a comet that's going to hit the planet. And they're trying to get, the White House and the media and everyday people to take it seriously and pay attention and try to do something. I mean, I feel like the movie's been out long enough that we can spoil the ending, but what is your stance on that?
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah, so it ends up hitting Earth. There's some stuff after that that's pretty funny that, plays out after the comet hits Earth. But it's a very political perspective. Adam McKay, it says, it's about climate change. He is, he's a Bernie bro. He's very progressive. He has a very intense political perspective. And it comes out in the movie, for sure.
It feels to me like another iteration of Idiocracy. This sense that, we are too stupid as a people, as a collective, in America at least. We are too stupid and too decadent and too spoiled and entitled to care about anything real. And so when the scientists surface this comet, everybody first blows it off. And then they see a political opportunity to make it like a wedge issue. And so the title of the movie, Don't Look Up, is like this movement where people are actually saying, just don't look at the sky. it is not a subtle movie, is what I'm telling you.
I do think there were parts of it that I liked. I didn't dislike the movie at all necessarily. I think there's a little more nuance than I was ready to give him credit for. I like the scenes where you were always watching people from around the world watch what was happening and just sort of be sort of victims or powerless or just swept up, just like the reminder that this is bigger. I liked, that one of the scientists sort of gets swept up into it at some point. I thought that was a clever statement. I thought the betrayals of the president and the White House and the sort of tech sector were a little overwrought. And, I watched it and I thought that he has a perspective that some people are stupid. I didn't feel like the point was everyone was stupid and doesn't care and doesn't want to pay attention. I might be giving him more credit than Adam McKay more credit than he deserves at this point, but with regards to just the perspective of this movie. I don't know what he wants, how he wants us to leave the movie. Are we supposed to leave the movie empowered? Because that's not how I felt. And it feels like, everybody who works in climate science, they kind of rail about this. All is not lost. And people who push that perspective are damaging the climate movement. I think Adam McKay is very invested in the climate movement and doesn't want that. So I'm kind of like, how did you think people were going to leave this movie? Empowered to go join, the Sunrise Movement? That's kind of my question is what were you trying to do here besides make a movie about how terrible our sort of reaction to global warming and climate change is?
I share a lot of that perspective. I thought that Leonardo DiCaprio was fabulous in this movie. I really liked seeing him go from behind the scenes nerdy scientist to celebrity and the realizations he had about himself along the way and the lack of self-awareness for a while and kind of how he evolved. I thought Jennifer Lawrence was good. I mean, I always liked Jennifer Lawrence, but I liked showing that someone who takes it really seriously just can't do media because we want media to have this chipper, upbeat, packageable hook, and we ultimately want to leave everything feeling good. So I thought that was a smart way to approach her character.
But it's how do you make that point when you're making a movie like this? Isn't there some irony there that you're arguing that mass media only cares about a positive spin and you've made a absolutely mass media movie on Netflix with every star imaginable about how the world's going to end? Like, I don't, that's where I'm, that's again, that's my question.
Yeah, and I've seen people describe it as a dark comedy. I didn't think it was funny. I didn't think it was empowering, as you said. I didn't think it opened any doors. Yeah. I didn't have a new understanding of someone because of watching it. I definitely don't think someone who is already disposed to think climate change folks are alarmist are going to change their opinion after watching this movie, because it is made with such disdain for people who don't take climate change seriously. So to me, it just, the doors that are closed in that debate were slammed shut in this movie. Not that it's his responsibility to open doors, but again, I agree with you. I don't know what the point is.
Yeah, because if you're going to make a movie with a like very distinctive political perspective, then I'm assuming you want it to do something except for just make you feel better about how shitty people are about climate change. Like, I don't know. That's what I read a Vanity Fair profile of Adam McKay. First of all, did you know that he is 6'4"? Mm-mm. He's a tall dude. Who knew? And in particular, I was interested in the breakdown of his partnership with Will Ferrell. Partnership and friendship. They are no longer speaking. And I thought that was interesting. And he kind of talks about, like, The Big Short was, and The Big Short is fantastic.
It is. I love The Big Short.
The Big Short does such a good job of, like, having a distinctly political perspective, but also educating and feeling like, okay, I get this. Like, you feel more empowered around the subject of, like, financial markets when the time the movie is over. And you got to look at Ryan Gosling the whole time. So that is a win-win. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, he talks about, like, people thought Vice was way too heavy-handed and unfair. I think Don't Look Up is more popular than Vice. And he got nominated for Oscars for both of them. But I kind of wish he would go back towards the Don't Look Up. Not because I think media has to have this positive perspective. But I think, you know, criticism, especially in the form of satire. You know, I forgot who, maybe this was a Malcolm Gladwell podcast, but somebody did a really great, or maybe it was This American Life, I don't remember, a long time ago did a really great podcast episode about, like, satire is, it's a delicate business. Because if you're not careful, and this happens, I think, a lot with Saturday Night Live, you just give both sides something to feel superior about without being very clear that, like, no, I have a perspective here. Satire, making people laugh in order to get them to think, is a delicate business. It's hard to do. It's hard to do well. And it's certainly hard to do if you have an outcome in mind for how you want people to feel at the end. I'm not sure Adam McKay had, and if he did, I definitely don't know what it was. But I just think if you're going to make a movie that's so distinctly political, you might want to think about that.
I thought Vice was exceptionally heavy-handed, but still provocative. Like, I thought the exploration of executive power in Vice and that idea of a unitary executive gave me a lot to think about, even though I didn't think it was funny because it was so heavy-handed. And I think about Succession and how he has a real disdain for these characters, but there is tenderness built into, like, he still sees them as human. And I just thought Don't Look Up was maybe too influenced by the pandemic. This idea that that people are so ready to fight with each other that we are completely disconnected from our own self-interest to the point of being disconnected from our own interest in survival. And while that is in some ways understandable and perhaps correct, it doesn't help. Yeah. And I guess I'm maybe some of it is. Post the intense days of March 2020, I am not in the mood to look around and decide that everyone is terrible. I want to figure out what we do about that.
Yeah. And I don't think it's correct. And I think it's intellectually lazy. That's probably, I think you're right. I think with Vice, at least he was asking interesting questions. I'm very confident he is not involved in Succession at the level that he is involved in these movies. He does. I don't think he writes episodes. I'm not sure he directs very many. I just think it's his production company. But something that's like, you can feel the difference, right? Like, there's not a lot of Adam McKay presence there. It's interesting in his breakup with Will Ferrell. Like, Will Ferrell's name on it, but he has nothing to do with that show because of the way their production company was ran. And, you know, when I read his profile, and this is true of a lot of art, like, I read it and thought, okay, well, now that I understand where you were in your life and what you were struggling with, this movie makes a lot more sense. It did not make a lot of sense as a commentary on either climate change or the pandemic. But you working out, like, some of your stuff from Vice and what you feel like was unfair criticism of Vice, and perhaps, like, some of the breakdown in your, you know, not the breakdown, but like the shifting direction of your career. Well, now that makes a lot more sense, right? And that, you know, that's often true when you know the background of where people are coming from. And this is all just me reading, I don't know, Adam McKay from Adam. I just read one celebrity profile of him, but I just think the movie, it wasn't not entertaining, I guess. It's just, when something's like that high of a production level, it's going to be entertaining no matter what, right? When you have Meryl Streep on screen and Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, like it's not going to be bad. I was sad that so many people watched it and felt like, yep, that's how it is, because that is not the experience I had. I didn't watch it and go, yep, we're the worst. Human beings are terrible. And we all know it after the pandemic and climate change. That's not the reaction I had to the movie. I thought, well, I see where you're coming from. I disagree.
I also don't feel despairing about climate change. I feel like we are in an era where there is much greater acceptance. I understand there's not the urgency that everyone would like to see, but private industry is moving on climate change. The world is moving on climate change. This administration is moving on climate change. You don't hear a lot of Republicans walking around disclaiming climate change anymore. Mm-hmm. I just think we are moving in a much more solutions-oriented direction on climate change. And so it was hard for me to watch in that way, too. I don't think we're refusing to look up anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, you know, what we struggle with here, too, is there's no one they. Like, who are you even talking about? Right? Like, I think that's what bugs me, is this idea of, like, and the movie is more nuanced. He does not imply that everyone reacts exactly the same way. And that parts of the movie where I wish he'd done more of that. Like, this is how people in this place would react. And this is how people, because that's the truth of climate change, right? Some people are going to be massively effective. Everyone's going to be affected, but it's going to play out differently. And the way people, this is what we learned in the pandemic, right? Everybody doesn't react to a stressful global event in the same way. To me, that's an interesting question that I would have been interested in a deeper exploration of, like, why do we all react so differently when all of our lives are on the line, as opposed to we all react the worst when our lives are on the line, which is definitely sort of what parts of the movie felt like.
Well, I am certain that many of you have feelings about this. Every time we talk about a film or a TV show, we hear a broader spectrum of opinion than almost any other topic. So we will look forward to hearing your thoughts on this movie, as well as everything else we discussed in today's episode. We have really good stuff coming for you next week that we're excited to share and talk about, including 5 things you need to know about electric vehicles. Between now and then, please do not forget to pre-order Now What? How to Move Forward When We're Divided About Basically Everything. That's the thing. We're in a moving forward kind of space around here. And we would love for you to pre-order and join our lunch team. Thank you so much for being here. Have the best weekend available to you. Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production. Elise Knapp is our managing director.
Maggie Penton is our community engagement manager. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener-supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Linda Daniel.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
The Creeps.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Emily Neasley.
The Hessians.
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Steigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Vallelli.
Catherine Vollmer.
Amy Whited.
Jeff Davis.
Melinda Johnston. Ashley Thompson. Michelle Wood. Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless. Paula Bremer. And Tim Miller.
There we go. Sorry.
How nice to have a dog.
Yeah, she's my executive producer. She doesn't work very hard. doesn't contribute a lot, but she's here.
American's great to her.
Yeah. All right, let me start over.